Well, I know I mentioned last week that we are going to be spending some time in the Sermon on the Mount between now and Advent. So many, many, many moons ago, I remember Ken Wilson doing a Sermon on the Mount series. This was probably 25 years ago now, and I still remember it as being formative. Like, it's something that stuck with me. I was probably in my early 20s. I was in my early 20s at the time. You know, I'd come from a background where I had a lot of church background. I'd read the Bible quite a lot. But even with all that background, like, I still kind of didn't know what the Sermon on the Mount was. You know, it was like one of those things, I'm like, I've heard of that. I know Jesus gave it. I kind of recognize some of the sayings, blessed are the poor, blah, 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 right? But I still was like, I don't really know what it is. I didn't know why it was given, where it was located in the Bible, or why it was important. So just say, like, if you're like, yeah, it rings a bell. I couldn't say anything more. Completely okay. By the end of these 11 weeks, you are going to know a whole lot more. And yes, I said 11. And I apologize, but like only a little, because I'm really not that sorry. I think it's going to be good. I think we're going to have fun. So this morning, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to introduce the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm going to set the stage for us, and then I am going to preach through one verse. So there are four Gospels in the Bible, right? So that's four books where we find the bulk of the stories about Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And we know that there's some differences between those because they were written to different audiences. There's also some overlap. All right, so what we call the Sermon on the Mount is primarily found in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5 to 7. All right, so when you hear people refer to the Sermon on the Mountain, that's what they're talking about, Matthew 5 to 7. And then there's a shortened version that's also found in Luke chapter 6, but we're going to concentrate on Matthew's version. Right, so in that gospel, the Sermon on the Mount is like Jesus' inaugural teaching. Right, it's his thesis statement. It's like the first part of his ministry. And so outlining this beginning part here in Matthew 5 to 7 is outlining Matthew's understanding of what exactly Jesus is calling people to do. Morning, Maurice. This is what Jesus is calling us to, how to live, how we're supposed to be in the world. And while it is addressed to a particular group of people in a particular time and a particular place, the essence of it is so practical and it's so widely applicable that it's impacted people around the world for more than 2,000 years. All right, so to engage with the Sermon on the Mount is really to enter this long discussion that covers centuries. Or people have been discussing it and arguing about, you know, what exactly this means, or what did he mean by that, or gosh, that seems really culturally specific. Does that still apply? Or if it does, like, what's the essence of that, and how does that apply here, right? And so we know that in the Jewish tradition, and Jesus was a Jew, wisdom is often found in that conversation, right, when that conversation is done in good faith, right? So debate done in good faith is meant to produce wisdom. So where did this long discussion start? It just started on a hill overlooking a lake. And that just sounds like a good day to me. Sounds gorgeous. And we're Michiganders here, at least most of us, or we maybe have located here, maybe not the Zoomies here, but many of us are Michiganders. We know lakes. And so I will say, this lake probably wouldn't be that impressive to many of us, right? It's not nearly as big as like Lake Michigan or any of the other Great Lakes. But it's also a lot bigger than, say, Whitmore Lake or Ford Lake. I don't think there are any like internal lakes on the Michigan Peninsula that are larger than the Sea of Galilee. So it's a significant lake. And scholars believe that Jesus, the place that he taught, have been onto that hill on the Sea of Galilee where they think it happened. They think it was close to a town called Capernaum, and that's where Jesus was living at the time. And Capernaum was just like a small fishing village, and it was right on the edge of this lake. So when I spent time there in 2007, it was helpful to just kind of get a lay of the land. So let me help us imagine the area a little bit, right? So you've got this big lake. There are these like rolling hills that I would say are not really mountains. It'd be real stretch to call them a mountain, right? These are kind of like foothills that are all around coming down to the lake, and they're dotted with trees and vegetation. So they're largely grassy, but they've got some trees and different things, especially down around the lake. You can see on a clear day straight across that lake, right? If you're looking east to west, it's about 8 miles across, but you probably couldn't see end to end, like north to south, because it's 13 miles long. The water's really blue. There's a few fishing boats dotting that, even today, just as in Jesus' time. And people go swimming in it when it's hot. I went swimming there, right? It's like little beaches around the area. So Capernaum was home to five of Jesus' close friends. And these were five of them that he had asked to come along with him and to be part of his team. So Peter, Andrew, James, John, and then Matthew, right? The same Matthew who was writing all of this down. And Matthew's job in town was to collect taxes. And then the other four of them were fishermen. Now, Capernaum, it wasn't a very big town, right? It had, archaeologists think, maybe 1,000, 1,500 people that lived there during Jesus' day. But I would say that for such a small town, it had a relatively large garrison that was located there for Roman soldiers, right? So they had a really big area there where Roman soldiers were stationed in this small town. And so the custom house where Matthew the tax collector would collect the taxes was probably located either in or near that garrison. And he would collect tariffs from the fishermen when they had a catch. So you can imagine that his job, at least before he stopped to follow Jesus, would not have made him a very popular man. Now, Capernaum might seem like a little bit of an odd place to like settle down and teach if you're like trying to reach a large number of people like Jesus was. But it was on a trade route, and so there were actually a lot of people that were passing through that area. It was like a crossroads of such in the area, so there were people that were coming from Asia, going over to Europe, and Europe to Asia, and so you had a whole lot of people that were coming through. And oftentimes, places that are like that are open to new ideas, right? Because they come across a variety of people, and I think that could have been attractive to Jesus. I think Capernaum actually makes me think a little bit of like the Ann Arbor, Ipsy area. You know, we're 100 times that size, but like we're also pretty smallish in comparison to a lot of the larger cities in the United States, right? So we're kind of a compact crossing point where a lot of people are passing through the universities and they're open to new ideas, right? So I suspect that Jesus was maybe placing himself strategically in Capernaum for a little bit of time there at the beginning of his ministry. And so with that background, let's look at the one verse I'm going to preach through today. Matthew 5, verse 1 says, "When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him." All right? When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. All right, so when Jesus saw the crowds, Pastor Daniel mentioned last week that Jesus seemed to have a lot of feelings about crowds. I think that's true. I think that is an astute observation, right? We know that he was aware that crowds could sometimes turn on a dime, right? They can become mobs, and he was wary of that. We know he often slipped away to recharge. And we know that he really loved people, right? Matthew 9, this is just a couple chapters later, we're told, when he saw the crowds, when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and they were helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. So we know that he cared really deeply about people, right? That he was moved by their pain and he was moved by their struggles. And I think it's just like God is moved by our pain and moved by our struggles. I think the Bible here is reflecting this heart of God for humanity through Jesus. And Jesus could see that many of his people, they were being harassed by the Roman soldiers. They were being burdened by overtaxation. Ipsy City. Sorry. They felt helpless. Right? They didn't know what to do about this. And I don't know about you, but I definitely feel just a little bit more anxious when I don't feel like I have a way to respond to something that's causing me distress. Right? A lot of us have that little app on our phone, like five calls, right? We're like, I don't know what to do. We also know Jesus was praying for and healing several people who were sick, right? He had gotten a reputation as a healer, so his compassion wasn't just for people who were harassed or who were overburdened, but also for our ailments and for the things that go wrong in our bodies. So the crowd that gathered around him when he gave the Sermon on the Mount, it was probably just a good cross-section of folks, much like us, coming from different walks of life. We're not told exactly who they all were, but we know that region. We know a little bit about its history and the area that they're in. And so you've got the people living there, and they're living in a beautiful setting, right? Some are visiting or passing through, but like, I think it'd be kind of nice to wake up, look at this gorgeous lake, these beautiful hills. Maybe if I was a fisherman, just going out every day and fishing, like that sounds great to me. But there was also this like violence that was sort of crackling underneath the social surface. And I think that we might understand that on some small level, right? Now, I want to be a little bit careful in saying this next thing because I don't actually want to like make an apples to apples comparison to like our current cultural situation in the United States to what was going on in Jesus' time. It was much worse in his time, I think. Doesn't quite compare. But let me just set the stage by saying this. Like in Jesus' parents' time, right? His parents, we know Mary and Joseph, thousands of people had been slaughtered in that region. Right? There'd been an uprising against the government. Hundreds were killed during that uprising, and then General Verus came down and he literally hung thousands of people on Roman crosses all through those hills, even potentially on the hill Jesus is teaching on. Right? It was all through the Galilee. And so those are the stories that Jesus grew up with. And those would have been some of the memories of the people that were maybe even sitting with them that day, like people who would have remembered that from their childhood, from their teenage years, or their young adulthood. And then pretty soon after Jesus' life, a million Jews were going to be killed. And again, that's something Daniel mentioned last week. We did not plan that. But it's helpful to know that in the setting of the New Testament, right? That context, a million people were going to be killed. And I think that that's really hard for us to kind of get our heads around as Americans, right? Because we've never had a war where we've lost a million people, right? The closest we've come is the Civil War. I think it was 600,000, something like that. And so we're talking about a million people in a time when the world population was smaller, in a much smaller space. And I just think those numbers for us are a little bit hard to comprehend. So I'm not trying to draw like a direct comparison, but where I do think we can relate here is that we do have some strong polarization in our country. Can I get an amen to that? A little amen anyway. Right? We can feel that there's a little bit of an underlying violence. We've got some political violence. We've got some school shootings. And so Jesus is speaking in such a context of polarization like that, and he has something to say. And I think we'll get to a little bit more of that in the part of the Sermon on the Mount where he's like, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you, like, we'll get there. But here's some little thoughts here. We have some people in our own culture who advocate for or who are maybe secretly cheering on or justifying political violence as a response to that kind of tension. And we saw that again this week. And so I just think it's worth saying, like, I don't condone political violence in the form of assassinations, attempts at assassinations, threats, bombings, any other form of terror. And I don't condone them from the right, and I don't condone them from the left. And I think for a while we were seeing more of those from the right, but now we're starting to see a little bit of an increase of that from the left as well. And so I just want to remind us that words aren't violence. Even when we find words offensive, even when we think they contribute to a hostile environment that can cause harmful policies, that can hurt people like me and my wife, even if we find those words rancid, right? That there is something that is actual hate speech and incitement to violence, but there's due process of law for that, right? Because that's not protected speech. But when we meet people that we don't disagree with, I think vigilante justice is not the system I want to live in. So I'll just say, I don't share many of Charlie Kirk's views. I didn't even really know who he was, to be honest. And I was kind of looking, I was like, oh, we might be able to meet in a couple of places. But yeah, there's a lot that I was like, oh, God, but he shouldn't be murdered for speaking them. And I know that like my heart was really broken for his wife and his two kids. And I thought like as Christians, we should be keeping them in our prayers, right? His wife was Erica. He had a 1- and a 3-year-old who saw it happen. I know like one of our board members just mentioned just like really feeling deeply moved by that. And so I hope it's okay or you don't mind me just saying that. But I also think sometimes we probably tend toward the left. And I think that we need to like have those discussions a little bit frankly about what it means, like how to sort of respond to that. Because we need to at least have some moral clarity of saying murder is wrong, you know, and some empathy for like when kids are watching, like it was just really hard. And so I want to lift them up. And also the young guy who did it and his family, right? It was just hard. But just as today in Jesus's time, there were also people who were like sympathetic to or advocating that kind of violence. Right? You had the zealots, you had the Sicarii. Right, the Sicarii would like take knives and like knife people or assassinate them in the street. And it's kind of understandable, right? They grew up in this area where there had been a lot of like government violence against them. They were known to permeate the region where Jesus was teaching in the Galilee. It was kind of known as like the central hub of some of these organizations. And so some people lean toward responding in this way during anxious times. They also have people who just want to disengage altogether, or maybe just like hunker down and focus on their own spiritual community or their own tribe, so to speak. A few years ago, there was a Catholic guy who wrote a book called The Benedict Option, where he was kind of advocating that for a certain group of Catholics to just sort of hunker down and ignore everything else. There were certainly people like that in Jesus's day as well. And then you have what I think is probably just the majority of people who are like, you know what? I don't have that much time or energy to like think all that much about this stuff. It's barely on my radar. I'm just kind of getting by. I'm busy caring for my elderly parents. I'm raising kids and trying to get into school. I'm building my business. I'm fighting cancer, for crying out loud. Like, I'm not thinking about this. And so I think the same was true in Jesus's time, right? A lot of people who came to listen to him, they were like, God, I just need some hope. I just need to get encouraged. I want to come to church and I just need to hear a little word that like God sees me and cares about what I'm going through and can help give me some guidance, right? And so maybe they were just attracted to Jesus's interpretation of how to live. You know, they're like, gosh, maybe I need a little bit of an ethic or framework because my life's not working. He has an orientation to life that maybe resonates, and they're like, gosh, maybe this could help me be a little bit of a better person. Maybe I could have a stronger family, a stronger community. Maybe I can find a little bit more internal peace. I'm feeling a lot of anxiety. And so I think Jesus is speaking to all of this in the Sermon on the Mount. And the fact that he was, I think, is part of why that sermon has found so much resonance through the ages, right? Because there's nothing new under the sun. Like, these dynamics are at play then, they're at play now. Like, they're recognizable to us. And so I think he's getting to the root of many of the hard issues, right? So it says he has compassion on the crowds. The next part of the verse says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. Now, I think Matthew's telling us something here, right? Oftentimes, high places in the Bible, right, the mountaintops, those are places where humans encounter God. It's a place where God has something important to say or to impart to humans. Often it happens on a mountaintop, right? We know a bunch of Bible big hitters. Like, so you're like, even if you haven't read the Bible, you might have like heard some of these people, right? Noah, Abraham, Moses, Elijah. All those people met God on a mountain at some point in their journey. So mountains in the Bible, they say, pay attention. Something's going on here, right? We could do a whole sermon series on the mountaintops if we wanted. Maybe we will. That'd be fun. Suffice to say, Matthew is saying, you know, Jesus went up the mountain. It's telling us this is significant. And I think it's a literary signal, right? Because like I was saying, in real life, mountain is a real stretch for this hill that Jesus was teaching on, right? So I think calling it a mountain is meant to telegraph that this is as important as what was happening with Moses and with Elijah and the rest, and to recall those stories to our minds as we're coming to it, right? And then Matthew tells us that after Jesus went up the mountain, he sat down, his disciples came to him. We find out at the end also all the crowds had also come, right? So basically everybody followed him up. And at that time, rabbis would sit down to teach their students, and their students would then sit at their feet to learn. So Jesus here, he's just sitting in the position of a rabbi or a religious teacher of authority. And I think in writing it the way that he did, Matthew is extending an invitation to all of us, right? To anybody who is listening to this, anybody who is reading it. It's like an invitation to come along also to be students on this Jesus path. Like, come, sit at his feet and learn. He's got something to say that's important here. It's his interpretation of Torah. He has something to add to this long human conversation. Right? And so what's Jesus going to add? I promise I'll wrap it up here. I think he's going to do several things. But I like what one of my favorite theologians, James Allison, how he puts it. James Allison is a gay Catholic priest, so technically he's Father Dr. James Allison, but that feels kind of weird to say from a non-Catholic. I actually met him. We did a very small workshop because he read through Solus Jesus when Ken and I did it. But he says, in passages like the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus was not teaching something called morals. He was making available an anthropology of desire, and one that presupposes an understanding of who we are and how ourselves are constituted. So in other words, he's saying, He doesn't see the Sermon on the Mount as like something that's just listing ethical life rules that we need to follow. But instead, he's seeing it as like a description of reality, right? It's a way of revealing how the human heart actually works. It's like an insight into what drives us, that we're created and formed to be shaped by desires that are reflecting a God who is love, right? And that we have these spiritual practices to help us learn to do that. But instead, we're so prone to like trying to reflect the values of others around us, and sometimes to pursuing things or to pursuing status, and things that lead to a lot of envy and rivalry, and to actions that bring destruction to ourselves and bring destruction to our relationships. And so Jesus here, he's diagnosing a significant human problem, right? It's like what happens when our desires run rampant and start to create these rivalries? What happens when our internal competition is so fierce and so destructive that it starts to like torch our connections with others? Competition, there's healthy competition too, right? This is completely off note and like right here at the end, but I'm just gonna give this story. Rachel knows, I think, what's gonna come. Healthy competition, right? One time we were sitting at Sidetrack, Rachel's parents were visiting. We'd had dinner and her mom, Gretchen, and I, we were fighting over the bill. You know, I was like, well, you know, it's our town, we're hosting you, like, we'll get it, don't worry about it. You guys traveled. She's like, no, we're like your parents, like, let us get the bill. And I was like, no, we've got it. And she's like, no, I've got it. And then she looks at me, she goes, let's arm wrestle. I was like, well, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm pretty strong, and you've got 25 years on me, so I think I'm gonna be all right. But you know what? My cocky little self got beat so hard. Let me just say, she was a nurse at the time, and she was running like a care home, and so she's like she's lifting people. She's taller, her muscle's longer than my muscle, right? She swears every time I see her that if we did this again, now that she's retired and that I'm lifting weights, in part to, you know, that I would definitely beat her. But you know what? I don't want to find out. Because you know what? If she beats me again, my ego just can't quite take it. But I think that's healthy enough. It's not destroying our relationship. It's building it like a sports team, right? There's healthy competition. What we're talking about is destructive competition, right? So James Allison sees the sermon that Jesus gives. It's like a prescription for rivalry reduction. How do we get those rivalries that live in our hearts under control so that we have better relationships and we have more just and peaceful communities? So that's where we're going. It's going to be a fun ride. With that, we'll have a little bit of meditation. So we often do a guided meditation or a little silence. And I thought today, I'm going to give you a good amount of time here with some silence. If it's helpful to you to just imagine yourself sitting on that hillside with Jesus, on a beautiful hill overlooking a beautiful lake, and just bring to him anything that's on your heart today. Like, we're all carrying all kinds of things. And let's just make some space to pray and have that connection with our Creator. I'll let you know when the time is up. Jesus, as we interact with this teaching of yours over the next several weeks, I ask that you would just help our hearts to be open to learning, that we can be open to maybe even disagreeing with you, to wrestling with it, to having good conversations within ourselves and with other people in our church community, Lord, that will help us to grow and to help us to better understand maybe some of what you were trying to teach us. I ask that you would give us wisdom. Lord, I just ask also that you would turn your face toward just all of the things that we're carrying this week, and ask that you would just show that same compassion that you showed to the crowds, that we would feel that compassion that you have toward us and all of our humanness, because sometimes it's really hard to be a human. So we just ask that you would shine your face on us, give us strength, and give us peace as we go through our week. Amen.